goodness, passion, and ignorance. Atmaka, composed. Atmani, on the self. Avedyaya, by material ignorance. Kliptaha, imposed. Samsarayanti, causes to experience the cycle of birth and death. Dehina, an embodied being. Translation. The material body, which has a beginning and an end, is composed of the physical elements, the senses, and the modes of nature. The body imposed on the self by material ignorance causes one to experience the cycle of birth and death. Report by Srila Prabhupada. The material body composed of various material qualities, elements, and so on, attracts and repels the conditioned soul, and thus entangles him in material existence. Because of our attraction and repulsion for our own bodies and other bodies, we establish temporary relationships. Dedicate ourselves to great endeavors and sacrifices. Concoct imaginary religions, make noble speeches, and thoroughly involve ourselves in material illusions. As Shakespeare said, all the world's a stage. Beyond the somewhat absurd theater of material existence is the real and meaningful world of Krishna consciousness, the liberated life of pure souls devoted in loving service to the Supreme Lord. Sometimes it's amazing how mundane personalities can have some deep insight, be so close but so far away. So Shakespeare's giving us the understanding that the whole world is a stage. That material existence is so many dramas, more like nightmares. And people are involved in the rearrangements of the 24, 26 elements comprising the Mahatattva. You think about having adventure and experience, being creative, and you only have 26, 24 ingredients to work with. After a while, you run out of combinations. After a while, you become bored. It's like if you put so many toys in the room for a child. At first, the kid is excited. The novelty of these toys. One is playing, the kid is playing with one thing and then something else later. But after a while, it becomes satiated. No longer interest in what is present. And so we see that people are constantly trying to gather different types of commodities. They're constantly trying to find ways to squeeze some enjoyment. And after a while, they realize that it's just not quite happening. But the desire for something ecstatic, the inherent desire for the ecstasy, is actually common to all living entities. Now we find more and more people taking shelter of intoxication. Although that is unhealthy and it's sinful and it's artificial, but the need and desire for altered consciousness or ecstasy, for experiences beyond the orthodox scheme of things, is an inherent part of the soul. And so there is this hunger somehow to not accept what is normally available only. And we see that, but people pursue something higher or something different, because in some cases it's lower. But they pursue as they're being influenced by different modes of material nature. So somebody is more captured by the mode of ignorance, somebody by the mode of passion, some on goodness, and different combinations therein. And this will dictate how people pursue trying to connect with the ruchi or the taste. The demons, there are some people who are so demonic that they get pleasure of violence, degradation. There are some people who are so demonic that they enjoy seeing other people in pain. Now we're finding so many people becoming crazy, becoming possessed. And much of their actions is that they pursue degradation. And we see that others are not so much enjoying to see somebody suffer or someone in pain, but they just don't care. They can be totally oblivious to, you know, the miseries of others. A devotee is supposed to be so concerned about us that opposition, we call each other Prabhu. You're my master, you're my master. Means that your life is so important to me, and my life is supposed to be centered around trying to understand your needs and to address your well-being. A Vaishnava is servant of the servant, Daso Smi, Dasu Nasanada. Param Dukha Dukhi Kripa Ambudi is to even to relish the happiness of others. At the same time, feel the pain of another. Like in the story, the marriage of Krishna and Rukmini. So Krishna is so concerned about Rukmini's misery and suffering. And of course he is so impressed with her degree of love. Therefore he is ready to go outside of the ordinary to give her shelter. Sometimes we do things for people, you know, when it's easy and convenient. And when it's not, we don't go there. We don't involve ourselves. Most people, when we're discussing their relationships, are utilitarian, and so they really don't understand how to be selfless. Some people don't even understand how to be genuinely affectionate and caring, because they haven't experienced it. And sometimes they have not only experienced it, not even interested in it. Because they've already accepted that there is no reason why anybody should be concerned or care about them. People have such low self-esteem, don't even feel that they're worthy to be cared for. And so many people are captured by this Hollywood romance and love. They forget that those people who are portraying in their act, in their drama, that in real life situations, they have some of the worst relationships. Sometimes they have divorced 6-7 times. And they often forget that those people who are entertaining them often are in extreme suffering conditions. That's why we find so many entertainers. They medicate themselves constantly with intoxications. Because they know that their life is somewhat of a lie. They're out and they're entertaining everyone else, trying to make everybody happy and satisfied and experience some pleasures. And so often in their own consciousness, they are so drained by the work, so disappointed, unfulfilled. But the thing is that often someone is a little bit more pious and they're trying to pursue some higher taste, but they will not let go of the lower taste or the lower activities. We realize that it's a transference of attention and energy and concern, that we are also active as the Vaishnavas. In the spiritual paradigm, things are very active, but it's a matter of the center. what is the nucleus. So the nature of spiritual acceleration is that one has to prove themselves. The prisoner doesn't just wake up one day and say, okay, I want to get out of here. The prisoner has to show that the character has changed. When you're serious about something, your actions really support the activity that you want to be about. Like after class, okay, I leave and I go to the airport. And then later at some point I go to Australia and Malaysia. So if I'm a serious traveler, I am being attentive to where I have to go, what the environment is. I pack clothes accordingly or facilities. And I get the ticket or the visa and the passport. Otherwise, I come to the airport and I say, well, is this airport? Yes. Is there a plane here? It's going to go to Australia? They say, yes. I say, well, I want to go. Lady at the desk will say, yes. Where's your ticket? And I say, well, hold a minute. Doesn't this plane go to Australia? Yes. Aren't people going to be carried there? Yes. Isn't this the line for the travel for the plane? She says, yes. I said, so I want to go. She said, where's your ticket? And so it's a sign that I'm not a serious traveler. I'm not serious about going there. Because I have not prepared myself. I don't have the money. Don't have the ticket. Don't have the passport or the visa. So when we are serious about trying to acquire a goal or go somewhere, our actions are healthily in accord to what is necessary, and we're in preparation, anticipation for the experience. So if we're serious about getting away from the illusions, then we have to start having a whole different mindset, different aspirations, different priorities, and we start preparing and begin to live like what we are going to enter into. It starts before we go there. As I am thinking of going to Australia, I am already in the mindset of what I'm going to do there and practically already there before I have physically boarded the plane. It's a sign that one is serious about going somewhere and is doing the necessary. So we really don't just somehow accept the illusion, have all kind of unhealthy priorities, and then think, oh, once we die, we're going to go to the spiritual world. We don't have all kind of unhealthy relationships, and then we think, well, that's only because it's temporary, but in the spiritual world, I'll be friendly to people, they'll be friendly to me, and everything will be okay. Not that we are Kanishtha Adhikars, and we are very focused on the deity, on Krishna, maybe focused on Guru, but no time for anyone else. And we think that this is going to help us to go back to the spiritual world. It's not that the living entities there are just waiting for Radha and Krishna to appear, and they don't care about anybody else. They don't have other powerful relationships, activities, concerns. Is that everyone is having some similar attributes as Krishna himself. And when Krishna distinctly appears in person, it just enhances what is already going on. It doesn't start it. It enhances what is already there. And so, as we can gradually begin to identify ourselves more and more through the eyes of the scripture, or as we read the scripture, we begin to embrace the scripture as like windows to the spiritual world. So we are observing to see what goes on, how to prepare ourselves, how we're to think, how we're to interact. We begin to take on certain characteristics like this. This becomes a serious sign that we're really getting ready, and we want the chance now to make the total transformation from the realm of illusion and under the influence of the Mahatattva now to absorption in the spiritual paradigm. Now, either environment one finds himself, there's a craziness. We're always intoxicated, either with ignorance and passion or with prema. And so one who's intoxicated by ignorance and passion, they are so engulfed, so captivated by the lust, and they're so controlled by the normative patterns of society, as if they're just being driven, and then we say forced. As if a current is just constantly drawing them into unhealthy situations, experiences. But this is also a perverted reflection of what goes on in the spiritual world. The entities are also captured by the environment, and they're intoxicated, and they're mad, madly in love, madly involved in preparations, where they lose themselves in the experience of selfless service. Sometimes we get a little glimpse of that, like during festivals or times when there's a lot of service to do. Sometimes we become so selfless and just trying to do what we can, we just give our bodies and intelligence and senses over to trying to do that service. Trying to cook for a lot of devotees, trying to organize this, trying to do the marathon, and you just become totally absorbed in the experience. So you practically forget about what isn't going right in your life, what problems may be there, what distractions may be there. Practically forget this. Because the mind becomes so absorbed. Well, this is a reflection of the absorption in madness, where in the spiritual kingdom, that everyone is just so absorbed in the experience of creating the greatest level of healthy community. Everyone is so absorbed in arranging for the festive activities that now are going on every single day, and every experience and opportunity is more exciting than the previous. We can't even conceive of doing something and being so happy, and then the next time we do it, we get happier and happier. It's not a part of the duality of the material world. In the material world, something that makes us happy one day or for a certain period, same thing after a while, become bored and frustrated. The very same thing. After a while, we become satiated in that. We have to look for something else. We can't imagine an environment where the more that we do certain things, the more it is like a fresh experience. But the soul is hungry for that. And that's why many people resort to mundane intoxications, because they just can't accept that this is all that they are going to experience. They want something else. They want an altered state. They want some kind of transformation of consciousness. And so they take the tamagun path. But the desire and the intense longing for the prema or the ecstasy is there, because that is ultimately coming from our nature of the souls interacting with each other. Now, where its big challenge comes is that in order to travel, in order to grow, in order to excel in one's spiritual life, often we have to give up something that we're attached to. Because Swami explains the nature of devotion. In the initial stages, we have to do some things that we're not always so excited with. This is the process of sadhana bhakti. We do first out of duty, and later and develop more appreciation. And we often have to remove or give up something that's unhealthy. And as we give up what is unhealthy, it also shows that we're serious about what we now are trying to become. Remember the story of the devotee who was devoted to Lord Shiva. And Lord Shiva directed him to Sanatana Goswami to be able to find something most wonderful. And as he approached Sanatana Goswami to get the best thing that he had, first he was given a touchstone in the garbage pile. Then later he came back and he was thinking, he has this kind of wonderful thing in the garbage pile, what he must have that he's keeping sacred. Sometimes you see people who live in wonderful states and they put out in the garbage things that other people come by and can use, and they come, you know. You think, well, this is what they can throw away, what they must have inside. They throw out a couch. It's basically still functional. But now they've gotten a new one. They throw out a bicycle. It's a little used. But now the kids have new ones. So you think, if this can be thrown away, what they must have inside. So when he revisited Sanatana Goswami, and he inquired, is this really the best thing you have? I want the topmost. Now this is, yes, I have additional. But he didn't just give it to him. He told him, first, you throw away, discard the touchstone. And then only after he did that, did he inaugurate him into the chanting of the holy name of the Lord. Now the same thing happened with Narada and the hunter. So Narada seeing his hunter, Mugari leaving all these species animals half dead. And he challenged the hunter, why are you doing this? Don't you know the consequences? But when the hunter could understand the karmic effect, and Narada wanted to assist him, Narada told him, but first you throw away your bow. Now this is a big challenge, because this was his livelihood, this was his art, it was the tradition, what his father, his grandfather, what was passed down. And so Narada was telling him, if you really want that which is better, you have to release yourself from that which will stagnate you and keep you as a prisoner. The hunter could have said, and also the devotee of Shiva could have said, no problem, but first, let's see what you get, and then we'll decide whether we'll, you know, we'll exchange. Let's see, put up first. It doesn't happen like that. We don't say, Krishna, I will be very dedicated to you. I will follow. I will give up all of my bad habits. But first, you make me a millionaire. And you will see, I will be a wonderful devotee. I will help facilitate so many projects. Or, Krishna, I will really be a good devotee. But after all, you haven't sent me a husband yet, so why you feel I should be so serious to you? You haven't reciprocated with me. Krishna, I will distinctly be determined. I will do wonderful service, but only if I have a partner who is even more enthusiastic than I am. Then you will see. We will both do amazing. We can't proposition the Lord like that. We have to be free from giving up on the unhealthy things. And that gives us room and facility for Krishna then to give what is healthy and beneficial. Otherwise, our lifestyle blocks what is accessible and available for our well-being. We don't realize how much we sabotage ourselves. We are calling out a warning, but we're sabotaging ourselves. But it's a big challenge. Especially when we are so comfortable with the unhealthy thing. devotee of Lord Shiva, so comfortable with what the touchstone was producing. If he'd been too comfortable, he would have just been okay with that. Or when there was the challenge, you have to get throw it away. He could have been thinking, but I've gotten this now. If I lose it, I'm not sure what I'm going to get next. I don't know. I'm coming. I'll be back. Or the hunter could have said, how can you ask me to do this? How am I going to protect myself? How am I going to gather fruit? This is my identity as a kshatriya. So all I do is go out, kill. How can you even think of asking me for something different? Think I'll kill you. No, it wasn't. This was the challenge. This was the crossroads. So we sabotage ourselves. We are at these crossroads. And we're not ready to take the risk. We're not ready to make the leap of faith. Many devotees don't advance very much because they keep failing when there's a chance to make that leap of faith and to go deeper and to get more. And so we see how in the case of Rukmini, she had also she was praying and pleading for Krishna to come and to rescue her. And she remained focused. And she was so focused, she was determined. If I can't have Krishna, I don't want anything. This was her priority, her fixation. She wasn't ready to accept anything secondary. She wasn't ready to hold on to the unhealthy, unnecessary. So we can't, the Christians say, you can't have God and Mama simultaneously. We can't have deep devotion and have so much Maya in our lives. It just doesn't go together. We can't even expect to have a high-level devotion and have an easy life. It doesn't mean that we have to be masochists and sadists, that we're enjoying suffering. But we should expect, second canto of Bhagavatam says, an easy life and devotional service go ill together. Meaning that the high-level devotion means anticipation and adventure and trying to capture the opportunities, looking at the possibilities, and agitating the mind about how to serve, agitating the mind and studying. You learn this and you learn something else. Now you're learning harmonium. Now you're learning other pujas. And now you're learning about this acharya. And now you're reading this and you're doing that. And you're constantly in a consciousness of trying to grow and learn and to experience more. And now you have plans to go to this place of pilgrimage and that place. But just to have an easy life and just coast and take things for granted and be complacent, it doesn't go well with devotional experience. Why? If you're in quicksand, you just kind of take it easy, you go down. We're in Maya's camp. We have to remind ourselves, material body and material existence is Maya's abode, Maya's camp. When you're in the enemy's camp, no question of getting too comfortable. Sometimes our devotees, they just get a little too comfortable in the temple, and especially sometimes outside, because it's easier to begin to take so many things for granted and to start settling in, like the people in the work, in the school, in the apartment, in the village, in the city. You begin to adopt some of their patterns. And so it becomes dangerous. Because then we're not giving up sufficiently what is necessary to be able to receive. So only after Mugari broke his bow, then he got full benediction of Narada. If he would have not broken the bow, distinctly showing that he's ready to change his life, he would have sabotaged himself. He would have sabotaged himself from being able to connect with the higher. The devotee of Lord Shiva would have not thrown away the touchstone. He would have checked himself, being able to be inaugurated fully into the holy names. If Rukmini would have just accept it. Okay, I'll just go on and accept whoever my family wants me to accept. Look me. After all, what can I do? She'll never get the intensity, have been intense enough to attract Krishna. And then Krishna appears, and he goes out of the ordinary into the extraordinary by doing a very special marriage where he came and kidnapped her. I was just looking, I wrote something down, about the different kinds of marriages, which is quite interesting. Let's go over them a minute. This is from the Manu Samhita. The Vivahas, different types of marriages. The first, there's eight, so different types. Vedic Shastra, Vedic sociology. And the first four are considered to be sattvic, or auspicious. And five and six are sort of neutral or tolerated. Seven or eight considered to be inauspicious. The first is called the Brahma or the Rajasika. The Brahmana marriage is considered topmost in a normal scheme. This is where the father gives his daughter his hand in marriage without expecting anything in return. So the father is sattvic, is devotional, and raises good children, gives his daughter a nice arrangement, and does not ask for anything. No ulterior concerns there. Then there's the Daiva, number two. The father gives daughter to a priest. So the Brahmana or a priest comes and performs some pujas, some ceremonies, is the priest for the family, priest for the village. And the father is thinking, oh, this would be a nice husband for my daughter. And so the priest is performing some pujas and yajnas, and as a way of showing appreciation, as well as accepting that this will be a good arrangement, and then he gives his daughter to the priest. Third is called Asha, where the girl is given based on certain situations or conditions that must be met. So here there's some particular variables that are there, some concerns, some conditions, and so the girl is given based on a little bit more of a business sort of contract, but something that's expected in the exchange. And then there's number four. These first five are considered to be rather auspicious. Number four is called the Prajapapya, where the fiancé asks for the girl. So the fiancé is approaching the family, and father and others check him out, and they think, oh, okay, seems like a good arrangement. They may do an astrological investigation, other things. And they decide, yes, okay. The girl is also willing. Five is called Ashuya, where the boy pays the girl's father in order to marry her. Just to do some investigation of his culture and some investigation of his consciousness. And then the parents are okay, but the boy has to pay the dowry. So Manu says that these, the first four, ending with the fiancé asking for the girl, is considered to be very auspicious or sattvic in the mode of goodness. Now, these next five, the Ashuya, where the boy pays, considered to be a little less auspicious. And then there's the Gandharva, number six, where two people decide by mutual attraction and agreement. This is, by Manu's terms, this is not considered the highest. People just decide, okay, you're the one for me, and I think you're the one for me also. Let's go for it. And one of the reasons That's something that is so important that it should be supported by the community, or should be supported especially by those who are most concerned about the welfare of the parties. So in Vedic times, there was less divorces and things, even though sometimes the marriages, you know, they were match marriages, they were made by the family. But one, because the families would be so similar. Two, because the families would be very scrutinizing and seeing about the possibilities. Three, because when there was a problem, the same families would be there, fully ready to assist. Because after all, they help put the marriage into together. And all players had something to do with wanting to see the happiness of the boy and the girl. Now, as important is that they were loved and cared for from all sectors. And they were willing to also to reflect on what advice was given. One of the things that makes difficulties in marriages when you have counseling is that often the counselor doesn't understand sufficiently the people. The counselor often is not accepted by both parties. And sometimes the counselor is just seeing them as clients. And after they're gone, has little to do with his or her life. But when one's own life is a part of others, then one is also helping them by helping themselves as well. And when somebody's giving you advice, and you're in conflict with someone, but you really understand and accept that that person who's giving advice really cares about both of you, then both of you are more likely to listen and to process what is being given. Often someone is giving advice, and one of the parties is thinking, but you're favoring him. You don't understand my needs. And so even though something is being given that's healthy, they're not accepting it or thinking about it in the same way. So in such case, there was a stronger support system to help to put things in place, to help to maintain, and when there was a problem, because there's always problems, there was an arrangement to resolve the problems. Now, these inauspicious marriages, people do something that is most important without support. And it makes it very challenging. Because it's easy for one to become infatuated. And it's easy for people to fall in love with their own idea. Sometimes people are very loving. And they are so much wanting a good partner that they meet somebody and they have the illusion that the partner has these attributes, and they literally transfer their own conceptions onto that partner. They put those labels on the partner, and after associating for a while, they realize the partner doesn't have these qualities. They fall in love with their own conception of an ideal person or ideal situation, and now they are really having some good wishes and hopes that the partner has that, and they've actually transposed those onto the partner, and it's not really the partner's own qualities. Now, with help, others may see such things that they don't see, or can help them to be more realistic in such ways. So that an initial excitement is always usually there. So when people just do these things on their own, it is dangerous. What to say of the fact that because such things are difficult, one wants as much blessings as possible. So you want blessings from Guru, you want blessings from the community. You want blessings from the elders. And so that was the nature in the Vedic culture. Wasn't that just, the father just says, okay, all right, you're 16 years old now. To get rid of you, let me find your husband. And he feels, okay, I've done my duty now. It wasn't like that. It was that all players were so interested in seeing that the marriage would work. And they would give so much help and assistance. Now, so many places now. Marriages, 60, 65, 70%. Yeah, ending in divorce. And that was officially ending in divorce. And how many people don't even marry anymore? It comes to our kids. Or they are living together and they really hate each other's guts. There's so many marriages where people live together and they are in anxiety or they're impersonal. There are a tremendous number of families that the husband and wife hardly talk to each other. The main conversation they have is, goodbye, honey, I'm gone. Hello, honey, I'm here. Dinner's ready. All right. Where's my newspaper? It's over there. And that's it. And it can go on for months and years where there's very little real caring for each other. Do you pay the bills? It's just like a business. Now we have these children, we have to work together as business partners. You do this and I do that. They don't really care about each other. And so, therefore, the successful marriages are so small. You look at the amount of divorce and the amount of impersonalism and then the degree of cheating. Statistics are very high in the West. It's coming all over the world. Amount of cheating that goes on in the relationships. So this, the idea of support was very, very important. But Krishna was so much concerned about Rukmini's feelings that he broke the unusual. The family was not so much accepting him. Because Krishna's pastimes are not ordinary. But let's go and look at the last types of marriages. So the Gandharva marriage is to decide by mutual attraction and agreement. And then there is the Rakshaksha marriage. Such a thing. That's by force. Kidnapping a girl. There's a fight. If he wins, he marries the girl. So Krishna was taking on this kind of marriage. He didn't care. He wanted to. Krishna will do all exceptional things to protect his devotees. He will even appear as a half man, half lion incarnation of Sringadev. He feels it's a promise. It's a promise. And then the last type is called the Paishyaka, which is the lowest. In this marriage, the man subdues or rapes a girl, or gets intoxicated, or she sleeps, and then he captures her for his wife. And so a lot of relationships are based on this last one. When people call themselves so-called in romance, they just intoxicate each other. Consider that to be something wonderful. So these, we said the first four are auspicious or sattvic. Five and six are tolerated. So really the normal relationship people have, the Gandharva kind of relationship, where nice boy meets nice girl and they consider, let's go for it. That is really not the best. Because there should be some consultation and there should be some way to bring others in to get blessings and support it. And as Vaishnavas, there should be some blessings from the community, from friends, from family if possible, from guru. We look at material marriages. You have the special names also, huh? There is the shotgun marriage. Uh-oh, we've created something, now we have to get married. Some accident has happened in the process of our enjoyment. Now I guess I have to marry you. You have my baby. I guess we have to get married. I have your baby. I guess I have to tolerate you now as a husband. Well, after all, let's go. Let's try. So, shotgun marriage. Then there's the common law marriage. People just live together. Consider, what's the need for a piece of paper? What's the need to be recognized by society that we don't even care much about anyway? So, no need. There's a need to be tied down. And people, they live together. And of course, then there's the marriage before elders. In some cultural situations, there's the cultural marriage where the rituals are performed, you know, by the chief, by the queen, by the king, by elders, such a way. It's not legal in the sense of going through civic law, but is using traditional law. And then there is, of course, the legal marriage, you know, by the minister, by the justice of peace, etc., where we get all of the certificates and whatnot. And then there is there's the marriage outside of the religious institutions, where one just goes to the justice of peace or something. And then there is, of course, another one is marrying in spiritual settings. You can see that the real essence of the marriage is that it's supposed to be something binding for helping each other they get married just based on the justice of peace. And then there is the undeclared, you see, polygamy, where people are not really understanding polygamy, but somehow they agree to have multiple partners. Or they agree to have partners as long as the other one doesn't know about it. He can do whatever he wants, but I just don't want to know about it. And so one can have one or two paramours on the side. And of course, then there's the same-sex marriages that are becoming quite common also. So there are so many ways that people are looking for partnership and bonding. And in most auspicious we see is when it is God-centered, Krishna-centered, and when there is also support and there's encouragement and there is some investment, where the people who are helping to encourage the relationship are also going to be there to help as issues and problems come forth. So what we discussed in this little class, of course, is first the fact that the body is just the illusion and the world is a stage, Shakespeare himself says. And so there's all these dramas going on. And we can just accept the drama and never get out of the nightmare. But we can realize that every day is another opportunity to perfect our performance to the point that we begin to act like the residents of the spiritual world. That the more that we are understanding what is available, the more we can begin to check ourselves to see that we're living like that, where we can orientate our consciousness such a way so we can attain such. And then when we enter into relationships, we want to find partners who can assist us in trying to move toward that goal. We don't want just a utilitarian relationship or a relationship that's going to be inimical to our spiritual growth and acceleration. And as we are putting Krishna in the center, then we are preparing ourselves, as we said, if you're traveling, you're preparing yourself genuinely, authentically, for what now you're going to experience. So when Krishna and his agents see that we're generally organizing our lives in single and partnership, putting our goals constantly before us, and trying to move faster and faster towards those ultimate goals. Then they will see that we are genuine candidates to be rescued. And just as Krishna has rescued Rukmini. So the opportunity for escape and rescuing is there. But only when our quality is of such that we make ourselves available to, you know, to be protected and to be brought back. So these kind of marriages help us to see also how people's consciousness influences the way they try to pursue a connection or relationship. We want to have the consciousness, we want to have a partner, or if that is the ashram we're in, where there is a constant fixation on spiritual growth, where we don't begin to take things too for granted, get too set back, then we lose focus on the fact that we are to travel and get off this stage once and for all. Hare Krishna. Any questions or comments? Anyone here? Mm-hmm. Well, that's why it's important to try to have some semblance of healthy community. It's important to have friends. It's important to have some mentors. It's important to have role models so that when we're making these important decisions, we can have some counsel, we can have some advice. We can have those to kind of help us and to steer us as we're making such decisions. And the most important things, decisions, should never be made only with oneself. Intelligent people want to look at additional variables, and then they may make their final decision. But it's important to, things that are, you know, very significant, to do them in community, to do it with counsel, with blessings. That's why, if you think about it, that's why in Vedic culture, the samskaras are so important. Because at every major important life experience or stage, it is to be done in such a way that the person is to be aware of what's expected of them, and it's to be done that the community is understanding what is going on in that person's life, and is also there to support them. So a particular ritual was performed as a way to gather the community together, understanding that here's a chance to honor this person, to offer blessings, and to be there to assist as there's knowledge of what the experience now is. But now, I mean, people have to struggle in such a lonely way. And therefore they make many bad decisions. You have the question? They do something and they wonder, why did I do this? Why didn't I notice this guy was a bum? It's so obvious, but why didn't I notice it before? Because I was intoxicated with possibilities and not being realistic. One was not getting feedback from others. One was anticipating and hoping against hope, but not being sufficiently practical. And it's realistic.
Mm-hmm. Among all these different types of marriages, is the same sex marriage also mentioned in the Manukam or anywhere in the Vedic literature?
Yes. If we had time, we could discuss it a little more.
not same-sex marriages, but there's emphasis on what now is being discussed as third gender. That there are entities, and even more and more in Kali Yuga, because our subtle body is a reflection or is an aggregate of different experiences, you know, in different lifetimes. And so we can have a particular physical body, and our subtle body may not always be, you know, fully in sync with the physical body. The subtle body may be an interesting combination. Because now, you know, there are so many relative things in society and culture, and people's desires are different ways, different orientations. And so we take a body, physical, subtle body accordingly. And so there was categories of people who were not considered either fully male or female, fully female or male. And they were in a particular body. Something would be considered like a third gender, neither male or female. And in some aspects of Vedic culture, like Prabhupada once explained that in India, there were villages and communities of people who were like that. And they were, most part, they were celibate. And so such people would be considered a blessing if they came to a yajna or came to a ceremony. Because they were considered to not to be active in normal scheme of activities, and that they were conserving their sexual energies, and be considered, you know, to be a blessing. And so it's not really something that's new. But often what we experience today is more of a kind of a lot of people have this sort of a bisexual energy. And that bisexual energy often has to do with people just, you know, just being lusty. And they, or being desperate, and they're just looking for affection here, for there, and there. And there's no chastity, and it creates a promiscuous lifestyle. But it seems that there's less distinct orientation about gender, it's like so many things now, you know, are unisex, that the environment will kind of bring forth more, you know, third gender people also. And the way people are living, where men are living sometimes more like women more like men. And so it can become confusing when there is the parenting. There's so many issues. But one thing we should realize is that the gay community is as variegated as the straight community. That you have all kinds of people in the straight, you know, so-called straight community. Some people are pious, people are impious. People are lusty, people are out of control, people are in control, people are opportunistic, some people are exploitive, some people who are selfish, some people who, you know, atheistic. And so you have all of that, the gay community as well. We normally kind of lump it all in. We think that, okay, someone's gay, they're like this, and that's it. But it's just as variegated as it's straight. Our philosophy is that no one should engage in illicit affairs. Whoever they are, whatever their preference is, or whatever their subtle body or physical body is. And so, if someone is neither man or woman, fully in consciousness or in subtle body, no problem. Thing is, to what degree is their life dedicated to the service of Krishna? And to what degree are they engaged in trying to develop prema or trying to engage in lust and kama? Just like that. Prabhupada's preaching, we see, was as well for men as well as women. For anybody, was just trying to encourage everyone in their service. But we understand that we do have distinctive bodies, and we have to deal with the packages, you know, that we have. But as Vaishnavas, we should always try to encourage people to follow the principles and try to encourage everyone to know that Krishna loves them, that there are services for them to the degree that they can follow and honor the principles that are given to us, which we create community by. Anyway, there's all different types of meritas, but there's, to my understanding, and from my own research in the area, haven't seen any sanction same the same-sex marriages in the Shastra. But there's definitely indication that there is what would be considered the third gender, that there are people who are not just only acting a certain way because of lust, but that they have a particular type of orientation. That one. Speaking of orientation, I have orientated myself to catch the airplane. I want to thank you all for letting me visit with you. It's been 3-4 years since I was here before. Maybe I'll try to come, once every year. So many nice devotees in the area. Nice deities, nice temple. Skand Founder Charter, Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Sri Prabhupada Ki.
Yeah.